The News Dissector with Danny Schechter, Fridays at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
And I'm Danny Schechter. I'm your News Dissector. I'm back on the air this week here on PRN, ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. You can listen online. You can also get the podcast of this program, which will be available later today, and I'll be posting it on my website at NewsDissector.com, and I'll also be made available on the PRN, ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com website. If you want to join us on the air, you can call 888-874-4888. That's a free call, 888-874-4888. Today, November 11th, 11-11-11, is a special day here in the United States of amnesia. It's a day of remembrance in some respects. It's a day of celebration of our military forces. It's been renamed Veterans Day. It was called Armistice Day to mark the end of World War I, the war to end all wars, as it was called at the time. It was a horrendous war. It led to more war, of course. World War II followed in a way out of World War I. We're going to be talking about war. We're going to be talking more about all this. And later in the program, we're going to be joined by Aaron Crown, who's the editor of MLImplode.com, one of the best financial websites. And we're going to be talking about what's happening in the economy where, you know, Europe seems to be in the dumper. The banks there apparently are in deep, deep doo-doo, owing billions, maybe hundreds of billions of dollars in losses on loans to nations that use the euro. Meanwhile, Greece and Italy, according to the New York Times, are asking technocrats to find solutions to their problems. The politicians apparently can't do it. They're too divided. The people are too angry. They're going to try to punt this issue into the hands of unnamed, faceless technocrats who are going to tell us what to do, and I'm sure there's going to be a lot of resistance to that. So we're in an unraveling position. We're in a situation where Christine Lagarde, the head of the IMF, says this is a lost decade. And that, you know, I don't know who's found it, but the bottom line of the bottom line here is brace yourself, because the worst is yet to come, and it certainly is on the way. And that's why we're meeting at a time when also Occupy Wall Street seems to be growing in influence and power, even though there are some in the media who would tear it down. The latest New York Post attack on Occupy Wall Street is that they've defaced, oh my God, the 9/11 memorial. Clearly showing their true colors, whatever they might be. And, you know, this is a battle, a media fight that's taking place right now. The good news about it is that last I looked, the popular support for the Congress was hovering in the 8 to 9% category. The president's ratings are at an all-time low, but even lower than that are his Republican adversaries. A recent survey showed that 47% of all Americans are supporting Occupy Wall Street as an idea, you know, to begin to try to do something about economic inequality in our country, to try to do something about an economy that's out of whack, a massive fraud, a massive financial crime that is just beginning to come out. We're beginning to find out more about it. If you look in the New York Times today, you come up with a new word that I love, baffled. Baffled. How's that for a term? Here's the context. Distortions in baffling financial statements. What it's about, a Floyd Norris column on the business section, is that you can't trust the financial statements of these banks. They use all these different fakakta accounting principles that are in conflict with each other. Even the banks say, don't trust our statements. You know, we're in a situation where truth is becoming harder and harder to find. Federal regulators want to audit all U.S. futures trading because of the movement of money from customer accounts into the company, you know, in this MK Global catastrophe, 600 million missing, and who knows how much more is missing. So we're at a time, you know, really of a financial crisis, but also of a major crime wave that hasn't been acknowledged as much. I write about it in my book, The Crime of Our Time, and in my film, Plunder, The Crime of Our Time. If you're interested in finding out more about it, you could go to plunderthecrimeofourtime.com. So that's the introduction this morning, but it's Veterans Day. People are going to be marching. Troops have been drilling for weeks to show off their stuff as they strut through New York. There's going to be a concert that's just getting going in Foley Square. Joan Baez is scheduled to be there, a free concert. Also, Veterans for Peace is holding a peace rally at Foley Square, and I guess we'll be marching back to Zuccotti Park later today. So all of this is going on as we speak, and it's all something that affects us all. I want to start off with a little music from A War Gone By.
The Yank came into town one day and said, I can't resist. I really must enlist. I had no hope to get that Kaiser Bill I hear so much about. He passed a test without his chest and started into town. It's a long way to Berlin, but we'll get there. Uncle Sam will show.
It's a long way to Berlin, but we'll get there. That was World War One. Berlin came back for a second crack at World War Two, and wars have continued. We don't know exactly even how many wars the United States is involved in now. Some people say 6, some say 8, some say 30. American troops are all over the world on various missions and assignments, many of them covert. So we really don't know what happened. We do know that in World War One, and I'm recommending a book now by Adam Hochschild, which is about the war. It's called To End All Wars. It's about not just World War One, but the peace movement, which has been totally ignored, that tried to stop World War One. And he writes here, he writes about a cemetery, 400 cemeteries in France, where British soldiers are buried in the battlefield region, a rough crescent of territory less than 20 miles long. But graves are not only marking the war, but are on the land. More than 700 million artillery and mortar rounds were fired on the Western Front between 1914 and 1918, and many failed to explode. Every year, these leftover shells kill people. Dotted through the region are patches of uncleared forest, a scrub surrounded by yellow danger signs in French and English, warning visitors away. More than 630 bomb disposal specialists have been killed in France since 1946. Like those shells, the First World War itself has remained in our lives below the surface because we live in a world so much formed by it. That's written by Adam Hochschild, the great writer worthy of reading. But we have two other writers with us in the studio this morning whose book has really got me going, okay, which is really an amazing read. It's called Stupid Wars, A Citizen's Guide to Botched Putches, Failed Coups, Inane Invasions, and Ridiculous Revolutions. Did I get that right? And the authors are here with us, Ed Strasser and Michael Prince, in the studio, live with us here on News Dissector Radio. And they have researched all of this. Both met at BU, Boston University, in the years when I was dissecting news on WBCN, and I'm happy that we have these Boston people here. Boston University, unfortunately, is known as the former home of that great radio personality, Howard Stern. But others who've graduated from there tend not to get the same attention. Oh, yes, I was just reminded, Bill O'Reilly went to Boston University, as well as many others who are too infamous to mention. But this book, Stupid Wars, A Citizen's Guide to Botched Putches, do I get that word right? Failed Coups, Inane Invasions, Ridiculous Revolutions, is important because it shows you just how idiotic some of all this is. And in the Michael Prince was reminding me earlier today about one of his chapters here, which touches on World War One. In fact, it was the chapter that they used to sell the book. It's called The U.S. Invasion of Russia. Did you know the United States invaded Russia? Yes, we did. And here to tell us about it, Michael Prince.
Thank you, Danny. It's the chapter kind of summarizes our entire approach to the book and to history, which is that there were these little corners that are so ridiculous that they kind of get hidden and put away by the people involved. So this invasion of the Soviet Union was such a dramatic failure that anyone involved with it needed to just bury it. If you look at any book about World War One, it's almost never mentioned. If you look at a book about Woodrow Wilson, who was the architect of this little shindig, it doesn't mention it in there either, because failure has, and the success has a million fathers, and failure is the stepchild that must be put into the closet. So the book kind of summarizes that whole philosophy, which is we kind of dig into the little corners of history, finding these ridiculous episodes that people just want to forget.
They also tend to define the larger picture as we now, our troops come home from Iraq to, a situation where it's almost impossible to find a job for most Americans, much less for these people who are kind of hyped up after serving their country and are going to come home and unfortunately maybe replay the experience of the Vietnam veterans who came back and ended up, really... eaten alive almost by the pain and difficulty both in their heads and in the streets of America. I mean, your book takes on this little episode and it refers to Woodrow Wilson, our president, who was known as a great fighter for democracy and a great liberal, if you will. The United States lost 100,000 people in this particular war. They say here, the skinny of it is, he was so arrogant, even the French hated him. They say here, he took on the commies when Senator Joseph McCarthy was still in grade school. He had a 14-point plan for how to run the world. It was four more points than God's plan of the Ten Commandments. And was this fun, going through all this? I mean,
it was really fun. I mean, this was a project of a lifetime for us. We're just fanatical history, military history people. So this was really just bringing everything together for us. And, the whole thing about the politicians is we really feel like they're the ones responsible for these things. And that's why we use this attitude in talking about these forgotten moments in history, these forgotten wars.
And when you do that, you must be... As you read into it and as you explore it and investigate it, you must be saying to yourself, this cannot be true. This is insane. And yet...
Yeah, the insanity question was something Ed and I burned out many hundreds of hours of phone conversations just discussing. You cannot believe what we just discovered about this war, about the Fourth Crusade, or about something that takes place in South America. And so it's all this mind, it's head shaking. The idea was we wanted to have numerous head shaking moments in each chapter, each of the 16 chapters we have, and I think we accomplished that. It's funny. We make fun of these people, especially the leaders, and we highlight some of the insanity more than a standard historian would, and we think that brings out the real flavor of how idiotic these episodes were. And
I mean, I'm sure, as you dug into it, and then you looked at the standard and conventional histories of the period.
Conventional history is a whitewash. That's what we really discovered. For what most people think of as history is really a whitewash. And so when you go back and actually read what happened and look into it, it's just crazy and amazing and stupid, a lot of the stuff that happened. And someone yesterday, a fan, read the book and said, how did you know this happened? And we said, we were talking about South American wars, and I said, well, we really just assumed that something crazy went on. And we researched it, and sure enough, it was crazy. And almost everyone, every subject that we investigated, we found out that it was a whitewash and that the reality was much crazier, much worse than
so
what was presented to us.
Sort of where delusion meets deception. And people are basically appealed to on patriotic terms to support something that they often know nothing about.
World War One is a great example of that. Obviously, when it started, every country involved was convinced that they would win and it would be a short, glorious victory. So somehow every country in Europe thought that they would all win and be home by Christmas, from August to Christmas. And the reality was that it lasted, it was obviously millions of people died, it lasted many years, And it's war is not glorious. It's not short. It's not quick. And not everybody's going to come home full of medals. It's going to be mostly it's going to be death. It's going to be a tremendous amount of money wasted. And the outcome is going to be muddled.
I mean, you write here, and I must commend the writing of this book also.
Thank you.
As a writer myself, I was, you know, very taken with this. But he said, as we studied the stupid wars, we discovered that there had been an understandable but dangerous tendency for politicians to play general and vice versa, and thus end up in very hot water. And, you know, you cite, among other things, the Whiskey Rebellion in the United States, where Alexander Hamilton actually invaded Pennsylvania.
He started in Pennsylvania and he ended up in Pennsylvania. So he went from Philly to Pittsburgh, and I guess he was like an Eagle fan, was going after some Steeler fans.
Well, at least he stayed away maybe from Penn State, which is in the news these days, for other abuses that are, you know, as serious. But, you know, you talk about things where people who take on wars invade countries about which they know nothing. And you talk about a handy invasion checklist, which should be tacked on the front door of the Pentagon. Can you tell me about that? Because, you know, we saw the Iraq war. You know, it's going to be a cakewalk. It was going to be over and before it began. And then lo and behold.
That's every war.
It's every war, the same pattern, the same dementia of political leaders. But
we came up with this list after studying Grenada, which really, you know, was like a blip, and it seemed like a big victory. It happened in a weekend. And then when we got into reading about it, we realized that it came up quickly, and it was seen by the Pentagon and Reagan and his crew that they were just going to make this big splash, sort of like, you know, like they tried to do in the Falklands. And the reality was all the different services weren't working together. They weren't ready for this. It really didn't need to happen. And so you had crazy things happening, like Rangers with no radios, and this infamous moment when they actually had to get on a regular telephone, call the Pentagon, who had to then connect a call to the ship offshore so they could talk to the commander.
They didn't have maps. Some of these guys, you know,
they had a tourist map, so they knew where to rent mopeds.
A lot of these guys basically, you know, jumped out of planes into the ocean. Four of them died out of 16 here. I mean, it just seems that.
And that's against Grenada. They had like 100 troops, and we barely won that one after a few days. And it goes to show, if you're facing a real enemy, the consequences and the what can go wrong is virtually endless.
You know, and this is important because, you know, we're talking now about the danger from Iran and the threat of Iran, and some of the same people who were so inaccurate when it came to Iraq are back. Richard Pearl, the Prince of Darkness, is going around doing interviews about the Iranian danger. And basically reducing everything to a few options, you know, military attacks by Israel, by the United States, covert warfare, and the like. And, you know, haven't we been down this road before?
We've been down this road, but, you know, the stakes are higher with potentially nuclear weapons involved. And so I think, you know, I think our rules, though, make sense for anything, that people should be informed. You shouldn't have to strike first in a war. I mean, World War II was, you know, a necessary war because we didn't do anything for so long, then it became apparent that it was necessary to do something. I think if we had held that to that standard in Iraq, we would have never invaded, and we would still, so it would be a different situation. And actually, probably Iran would have been weaker now than they are today because of that. So
in a sense, Iran won the Iraq war.
I think so.
You know, in terms of the influence of, you know, I mean, you know, for reasons that wasn't totally Iran's doing, but, you know, the Shia had been oppressed by Saddam, and many of them had, you know, kind of fled into Iran and had studied there, and some of the Ayatollahs who came back from Iran, and they were, you know, basically supportive of Iran because Iran had taken them in and taken care of them. So, you know, you have a situation here where suddenly, you know, lost in all of this discussion of, you know, my God, Iran might have a nuclear bomb. Shh, could happen. You know, I mean, nobody even knows how many nuclear weapons Israel has. They're not saying. Could be 650. The United States, of course, 30,000 plus. Russia still has 30,000 plus. I mean, it's not necessarily true that having a nuclear bomb leads to the use of a nuclear bomb. So far, the only people who've used it has been the United States at the end of World War II. I mean, you have Pakistan has nuclear weapons, so does India. They haven't really had a nuclear exchange. I mean, I think part of the reality of this is very confused. I mean, I was in Iran. I'll give you a little story. As a judge in a film festival last year, and I showed my film, WMD, Weapons of Mass Deception, which is a film about how the media sold us the war in Iraq. And, you know, we were talking about, you know, I raised the nuclear issue. I said, you know, look, Iran has a right as a sovereign country to pursue its objectives. However, you know, we do have nuclear proliferation agreements. It probably would be a better idea not to have more nuclear weapons kicking around than to have them. I'm not talking about your right to have them, but I don't see any concern here in Iran with nuclear energy and nuclear technology, which has a capacity for tremendous danger, accidents, as we've seen in Fukushima, etc. and so forth. The reaction in the audience was like, you know, furious at me. You know, they were like, nobody had ever raised the environmental issues with them before, right. It seemed like. They were just assuming others have it, so we should have it, and it's wrong not to let us have it, etc. and so forth. And when I raised these other questions, I got a good argument going among Iranians, and some of them agreed with me about it, you know. But it was one of those, you know, hidden issues that never gets discussed, like the hidden wars that you guys talk about here, that seem to indicate a capacity to make the same mistakes over and over again. What does that teach us about human behavior?
It seems like people just think that history doesn't happen, and you can just ignore the lessons. And the Iraq War is a great example of that. The Colin Powell fought in Vietnam, and the lesson he learned was you don't fight a war unless you have overwhelming victory and can get out. You go in, you win, you get out. And he applied that when he was with the first Bush administration in the first Iraq War. We won, we got out. Then in the second Bush administration, he was confronted with Cheney and Rumsfeld, and he got rolled, Powell, and the whole idea of go in, win, and get out was thrown out the window. So Rumsfeld and Cheney forgot the lesson of the first Iraq War, where they were major, you know, participants of it. So people don't listen, people don't learn, people are free to make their own mistakes. And if you're a president or a dictator or a general, those mistakes can be pretty dramatic.
I mean, one of the things that, as a journalist, trying to be a journalist, let's put it that way, you know, is that usually there are two parties fighting in a war, okay? In Iraq, in the American media, there's only one party. There's us, okay? It's, quote, AAU, all about us. It's about our soldiers. It's about our goals. It's about our objectives. And the Iraqi people are kind of invisible for the most part. It's almost like a Hollywood set, you know, where Iraq doesn't exist, and Iraqi civilian casualties and Iraqi resistance to all of this tends to be characterized only in terms of terrorism, al-Qaeda, etc., etc. And so the actual dangers of doing this invasion were never really brought forth to the American people. And this is something that I think is very troubling.
Definitely. I mean, it's, you know, it is by definition, it would be one of our stupid wars if we do another book, probably, because it has gone on and on. There's no real ending because it was started for spurious reasons. Not that Hussein wasn't a bad character, but you know, you really have to have solid reasons and a plan and overwhelming force to solve the problem. And so few of those situations really in life and history really meet those criteria. So that's, and everything else is a stupid war. And that's what we...
Well, you know, I can talk about stupid journalists because I've been exposed to many. But what about stupid historians? I mean, you know, our whole narrative of history is taught by people who are supposedly in the know, who have studied it in great detail, who are, you know, very knowledgeable. And yet when you really look at it, you find, like in journalism, there's more omission than commission, if you will. There's more stuff left out that is often telling.
Yeah, there's two things about history books which we really didn't want to fall into the trap. And the first one was, in military history books, they kind of ignore the people. It's all about this division did this and these troops did this. And we really tried to focus on telling a story in each chapter about some of these critical people. And the second point we tried to do was to not fall in love with our subject. If you're writing a book about Woodrow Wilson or George Washington or whoever, some German general, it's almost a tendency to love the guy to death, and therefore you omit negative stuff about that person. I think it's just a natural tendency. We had no desire to love any of our subjects. We were writing about Hitler and South American dictators, and so we felt we were free to just lambaste these people and point out all the idiocy and all the stupidity that they did, such as Woodrow Wilson drafting up this invasion of the Soviet Union. He did it in his den, typed it himself, handed it to the general, and basically said, this is your marching orders. It's to invade Russia, but don't really cause too much trouble. And to be a president and to sit there making believe you're some sort of general dictating orders to the troops is absurd. You know, he didn't really confer with anybody, figure out how you're going to get your troops from Vladivostok across the entire continent to overthrow the Bolsheviks.
He needed this book.
He needed our book. He needed us to consult.
You know, we both took Howard Zinn's course at BU, and I think, you know, that spirit maybe has helped us have a real attitude on history.
Let's remember Howard Zinn, who was the author of The People's History of the United States and many other books, who raised really important questions, not only about factual events, but also how they were represented and presented. He was a good friend of mine, and you know, we miss him terribly. And his passion about all of this came out of his concern about war, came out of being a bombardier in World War II. He was actually involved in bombing people, you know, and he
drew, had first-hand knowledge.
Yeah, and he drew from that experience and reflected on that experience, and it led him to oppose wars, whereas it seems like some military people do that, but not all.
Yeah, I think George McGovern was also a pilot in World War II. He was a bomber pilot in Europe.
John McCain was, of course, a prisoner of war and a bomber as well, you know, in Vietnam. But, you know, again, the real history of what happened with McCain and what happened with World War II. World War II is a good war. You know, so we don't look too deeply at Dresden, at the bombing of civilians, at various crimes that took place during that war on the Allied side. We know about the Nazi concentration camps. We know about the horrors there, and as well we should. But there's a more to the story, if you will. You know, today is Remembrance Day in Britain, where the anti-war movement is raising some of those issues here. There's a concert, and there's a rally, but it doesn't have the same significance, maybe because Britain was bombed, whereas America wasn't really, except at Pearl Harbor.
Right, right. I think, you know, I think the guys who were in the war, you know, at some point maybe they, in their later careers, they decide they're going to step out from the power structure and try to figure out ways to stop wars, or some of them just stay in the power structure. And, you know, I think that's what, you know, ultimately we want people to think about. What, you know, what is actually happening on the ground, wherever it is, and if it's a war situation, it's, you know, it's not good.
Well, you know, guys, are you thinking of doing another book on this? This would be a great documentary too, I think. Stupid Wars, you know, kind of with analysis of all of these patterns and relationships here, because again,
Dan, is that an offer to work with you on this?
Well, you know, if you can bring the money, I'm there. You know, that's the problem with making documentaries. Becoming more and more difficult to raise money to do it. Mm-hmm. Gary Null has just done a few excellent documentaries. So, I mean, it can be done, obviously, but it's difficult. I just did a short documentary which people might find interesting about Occupy Wall Street. It's on the Press TV website, a program called Inside Focus. You can look it up, Press TV, go to programs, go to Inside Focus, and you'll find this kind of behind the scenes of the occupation film that I did there. It's a half an hour program that you might find interesting. I find it interesting that after working for ABC, CNN, CNBC, the only people who really asked me to do anything was Iranian TV, and concerns about, obviously, but you know, they have their own reasons for doing it because they feel the United States propagandized against Iran so much, so they're going to do something to show the United States up and whatnot. But nobody told me what to do or how to do it. I wasn't censored. I wasn't suppressed. And I can't see that that would have happened if I had done it for an American network, having been at ABC for 8 years and knowing how things work or don't work in that environment. It's not exactly, every day that people have freedom to really do the reporting and to ask the questions that they believe need to be asked. But this is something I'm proud of. It's a short little film about how Occupy Wall Street really functions. Press TV programs, In Focus is the name of their show. And, you know, check it out and tell me what you think. You can write to me at the dissector at mediachannel.org. This book is published by Collins, which is a Murdoch imprint, which is...
Yes, it is.
Which is interesting in itself, since the Murdoch Press seems to be a big booster of wars, and the Murdoch Publishing Company is publishing this book about stupid wars by our guest this morning, this afternoon, Ed Strassner and Michael Prince. Guys, feel free to use the podcast of this interview on your website or in any way you want to promote this book. I really recommend it to listeners to check it out. I want to thank you again for coming in today. We're going to go out now with a little more music from World War One.
Progressive Radio Network, information for the independent mind.
November is a time for saying thanks. So here on PRN, we're giving you a feast of great programs all month long, including Expanding Mind with Eric Davis.
The last time I was in Paris, I had the opportunity to go to see the illicit side of the catacombs, and it was a marvelous, crazy, drunken night that began with a whole group of us being led by somewhat shadowy figures who, by the middle of the evening, proved to be completely unreliable because they were inebriated to the point of catatonia, which produced its own interesting experiences.
The Solution Zone with Christiane Brown.
People are looking backward at one of the largest mass arrests in U.S. history, the arrest that took place of more than 700 peaceful protesters on the Brooklyn Bridge.
Possibly 3,000 police officers have just arrested
Exploration with Michio Kaku.
If you are a conspiracy theorist on the web, then you probably heard the fact that this past weekend, a doomsday comet zipped right by the planet Earth, and some people feared it could be a harbinger of doomsday itself. Well, astronomers have been tracking that comet, and their basic attitude is, what's all the fuss about? It's no doomsday comet. It's basically a dud.
And our newest show, Honesty Without Fear, the Whistleblower Radio Hour with Steve Cohn and Jane Turner.
This is 1 hour of progressive radio set aside for whistleblowers, where the public can learn about the contributions and what whistleblowers are saying about the major issues facing our country today, where whistleblowers can learn about their rights, where the public can learn how to take action to stop the retaliation.
Listen live or anytime on the archives at prn.fm. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
The Progressive Radio News Hour features in-depth discussions and full disclosure of cutting-edge world and national issues. Distinguished guests explain them, taking aim at policies harming so many people worldwide. Change comes through understanding and a commitment to something better. The Progressive Radio News Hour is dedicated to working for it by providing listeners with vital information they need to know. Listen Thursdays at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, as well as Saturdays and Sundays at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
This is PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
To chase and to walk home via Wells Fargo Sally Mae, to MasterCard and Citibank, and also BofA. American Express and Visa.
Well, people who have been listening to this program, News Dissector Radio, here on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, or have read my book, The Crime of Our Time, or Plunder, or my film, Plunder, The Crime of Our Time, know that I've been obsessed with this financial crisis for some time, for many years, basically hoping, praying, encouraging, you know, every sign of protest I could find, and for the most part, feeling completely abandoned by progressives who were really more interested, it seemed at times, in bashing Sarah Palin than the Bank of America. But now that's changed, thanks to Occupy Wall Street and the Occupy movement, and this issue is now back in the news for, you know, basically for the last year. The only economic issue we've heard about repeatedly has been deficits, 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 and now for the first time, economic inequality, economic justice, practices by banks that are repressive and oppressive is finally in the news. And we have Occupy Wall Street to thank for that, and changing to some degree the national conversation. I still find it's better to watch foreign channels report on it than American channels. But nevertheless, it is getting out. If you look at Google, there are thousands of references to stories about Occupy Wall Street. There's a website you should definitely visit, owsnews.org, which is produced by David DeGraw, who's the guy that has been on this program, who helped coin the phrase the 99% versus the 1%. There's also an app on the iPhone, at least. I don't know about other phones, for Occupy Wall Street. So there is information available easily to find out what's going on. Occupy Wall Street has a whole bunch of different websites. It has a live stream. It has a Twitter feed. It has a Facebook page. I mean, it's just endless efforts to communicate. And, you know, it's something where if you get involved and go down there and participate to some degree, I think you'll be very inspired by the sincerity of the people. They may not be, you know, all PhD economics professors, but they definitely understand these issues, and they are caring about them. They are trying to raise them in various ways. Many have been arrested. Yesterday, somebody near Occupy Oakland was shot. A gunfire was reported. I mean, I don't know all the details of that, but this is a movement that is growing. And I even reported in my blog today that the head of the Tea Party in Rochester, New York, has called on the mayor not to eject Occupy Wall Street. And he says he's going to join a march. It's because he believes that if their rights are taken away, the Tea Party's rights might be next. So that's an interesting initiative, an important one. You can read about that on newsdissector.com, my website. Joining me today is another web journalist, somebody I respect and admire a great deal because of his commitment to truth, of trying to offer information about what's really happening to the economy, not through the lens of, you know, the institutions that are like in league with Wall Street, but from a perspective that's more critical, more independent, and more factual in my experience. MLImplode.com, the web-implode.com, the website and websites that he edits really is something that should be on your must-read list. His name is Aaron Crown. He's joining me now. Aaron, how are you? And you're monitoring all of this as I am. It looks pretty bad in Europe, doesn't it?
It does, and that's been a continuing situation for a while because of their inability to really acknowledge the full extent of the problem and to push the cost of that onto the financial entities that put them in that situation of odious debt, I would call it.
I mean, it is a situation where, you know, I've seen it compared to like financial AIDS, you know, spreading. Remember there was one person who apparently brought AIDS to Canada, which then spread to America and spread through the world and all the rest of it. And, you know, this is a situation of contagion, what they call contagion, which means that, you know, something that starts one place is contagious and spreads somewhere else. And it seems like the mindset of the bankers, the mindset of the central bankers, the mindset of the people, of the one percenters in all of these countries has been me, 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 not we, we, we. It's been really an effort to try to get rich quick. And in many cases, it's led to a tremendous downturn, which is happening now. I mean, I don't know what the outcome is going to be.
Well, we can extend your disease analogy a little more. That if you have a vulnerability like a nutritional deficit, then the disease, the contagion, is going to spread more readily. And I think in this case, there is a parallel, and that is the insolvency of the financial institutions, which comes from excess leverage, which in turn is very much built into our system as a centrally controlled debt-based monetary system that is controlled by the big bankers. And so as long as that remains the structure, then we remain vulnerable to this contagion and essentially a state of permanent emergency where they continually have to come in and bail out the big banks as they repeatedly get into trouble.
Well, you know, it seems to me to be a situation where they just don't know what to do. You know, these are like supposedly the smartest people, not just in the room, but in the world, who are in touch with each other, highest levels of technology, sophistication, and the rest. And it seems like every step they take is like, you know, walking down the road and there's poop in the middle of it, and you walk out of your way to step in it. You know, I mean, it seems like they have created a situation where there's no escape, you know, in a way. It's like,
right. The best solution they've come up with is what they have been bandied about is what they call financial repression, which is to try to gradually inflate away their debts by, you know, various forms of money printing, and to reduce the impact. They've sort of realized that the system is so broken they can't grow their way out of it like they used to, with, you know, increased GDP. But are just rather going to have to print money until it reduces the real value of the debts. And unfortunately, that philosophy, especially in the context of the bankers getting all the printed money, it ends up impoverishing the 99%.
You know, this is a reference of, you've heard before, to, you know, Helicopter Ben Bernanke, basically
exactly.
Showering, you know, the world with American dollars, the printed at the Fed, or printed, you know, and basically with nothing to back it up, essentially. And, you know,
but not the whole world, just the,
the world
privileged
of
and powerful.
The financial world.
Whereas, you know, yeah, they have money at essentially 0%. Try to get that on a credit card. You know, you're lucky to do better than 10%. And if you're like most people, probably 15 to 25%.
I mean, this is
very much a double standard.
This is a world which is so obtuse or so complex that it's hard. It's designed in a way so that we can't understand it. I mean, this is in the New York Times today. I mentioned this earlier. you know, it's Floyd Norris writing. He says, this has been a bad year for banks. With sovereign debt no longer trusted and widespread fears of a new recession in Europe, I keep hearing fears of a depression in Europe, share prices of banks have fallen sharply. But in some cases, the financial statements look ever so much rosier. And they go in to discuss how the actual accounting practices that these banks use are completely deceptive, okay,
right.
Based on rules that they themselves created and promoted to try to benefit from. Now they want to get rid of them, okay? And what you end up with is what the New York Times calls a mess, okay? And it's lovely when terms like baffling get in the headlines, you know, distortions in baffling financial statements.
Right, and that segues nicely into another current event I wanted to mention, which is the MF Global brokerage collapse. I don't know if you've seen much discussion of that in the news. My impression has been
That's been quite a bit in New York because of Corzon.
Right.
You know, I mean, but it's been a lot of it is, you know, he basically resisted the regulation. The regulator was a friend of his. You know, he took on all of this leverage. He was under a lot of pressure to turn things around quickly and, you know, basically transferred apparently money from client accounts to the company to try to save it. It looked like it was working until, boom, it wasn't. And now he's resigned, but nobody's accusing him of any crimes.
Right. I think there's a lot of lessons in this. I mean, one dovetails with what you were just saying, that everything, you know, looks apparent on the surface that it's the finances are fine. Like in the case of MF Global, no one really believed there's any sort of problem until really the week before they filed bankruptcy, when the financial conspiracy sort of site Zero Hedge was raising a bit of a red flag. And sure enough, you know, they collapse within a week. So, you know,
it's almost like
really
Bear Stearns, you know, here
really
today, gone tomorrow, you know.
They're really discrediting the market. That's the interesting thing about this, and kind of the ironic thing that with all the Hail Mary plays that they've put in place to make themselves appear to be sound and solvent, that it's coming to a point where no one is going to really be able to trust the numbers that they publish as having any real meaning.
Have you seen... I'm sorry, go ahead, finish.
They certainly didn't for MF Global.
To me, this is another classic case of, you know, capitalists bringing down capitalism, you know, and discrediting capitalism. I mean, the reputation, you know, I was saying earlier, reputation of the Congress now has about 8%, 9%, you know, approval, you know. Obama... maybe twice that, the Republican candidates even less than that. It seems like the country, the level of confidence is so low. And, you know, these institutions, which once had these big reputations that they purchased through a lot of advertising and other philanthropic efforts, et cetera, are now also, you know, in the toilet. And they're on the defensive. You know, big banks in New York were pleading with customers, please don't move your money from our banks. Okay, people who were saying, you know, it's money moving day. We're going to move it to credit unions because we don't trust you. And, you know, this element of trust is really important. How do you have a banking system if people don't trust it?
Right, and there's not much left to trust with all this going on, and not just with the institutions themselves and their financials and how they treat people, but the market itself. I mean, the market is never seems to be doing as well for our portfolios and our retirement accounts as it does for these big brokerages. And there's a variety of reasons that's the case, but I mean, it seems to me it's turned into a mechanism to basically shear the populace like sheep.
They you know, siphon so much money off into compensation schemes, bonuses, you know, paying off settlements in lieu of accepting any responsibility or accountability and the like, you know. And so you have, you know, a situation where really a kind of a trowel. You know, they're basically, you know, sucking the money out, you know, and into their own pockets, transferring wealth.
and an effect of all this high-frequency trading, which is what most of the market activity is now, is exactly that, that even the market trading itself basically continuously skims off people that are buying and holding for the long haul and just basically, you know, plays them for dupes and pushes them around again like a herd of sheep and occasionally pushes them off a cliff.
Have you seen the film Margin Call? You heard about this?
I have not, no. I actually tried to rent it the other day and they didn't have it.
It's a fabulous film. You know, it's the story of, you know, it starts off on a day when a whole group of, I'm going to tell you a little bit about it, you know, people from human resources or other professionals come in to fire half the staff, okay? And basically, they're, you know, having meetings with everybody and saying, here's what your payoff is going to be, you're out of here. And this one guy says, well, wait a minute, I'm working on something really important. They said, that's okay. We'll take over, sir. No, you don't understand. This is something that is really, I'm in the middle of this, you know. No, that's okay, sir. You know, we will take responsibility for it now. Thank you for your service. And our security man here is going to escort you to the door. Here are two boxes to put any personal effects into, and you're out of here, okay? And then when he gets downstairs, he finds out that they shut off his BlackBerry, okay? And he doesn't have a phone, and he throws it into the, you know, onto the street and breaks it, and what have you. And then as he's leaving the building, he has taken some data and put it on one of those little flash drives, okay? And this young guy who is his assistant is, you know, walks to the elevator to say goodbye to his boss, and you know, the guy is basically saying, look, take this, see what you can make of it, he says, and be very, very careful. And the guy takes it, okay, and discovers essentially that there's no money left in the company. And the company is completely, all the figures, all the claims are completely bogus, and that the company is bankrupt, essentially. Defunct.
Yeah.
And the story is about what happens then, how they decide they're going to have this final sell-off and sell off all their, you know, all their bonds and stuff for fire sale, basically, to get it off the books.
Right.
Even though they know that they're selling junk to people who are buying it in the expectation that it has some value, and in fact, that has no value. And it's a great, kind of very underhyped story, Margin Call. It's in the theaters here in New York. If you get a chance to rent it, please do. You'll find it very interesting. So in terms of your, you know, basic crystal ball here, Aaron, where is this all going?
Well, I think we're going to have to see more extreme bailouts and money printing, I mean, especially in Europe. I think the Fed is probably going to swing back in. We'll probably have another major market swoon. The Fed will swing in and be more more of an activist with its printing activities. And as far as, you know, any hope for meaningful reform, I think we have to look to the Occupy crowd and those doing similar things as being agents of change and kind of keeping that flame alive. Because I don't see anything certainly fit and unjust coming from the authorities.
The super committee, what are they going to do?
The prognosis for that does not look good. I don't think anything significant will come out of that. It could turn into a major debacle that would really kind of kick the markets when they're already down or heading down.
I mean, it just seems as if so many people who are supposed to get it don't get it. And they're ideologically, you know, basically committed to certain propositions which in the real world end up causing more misery. Austerity is going to save us, you know.
That's a cover for staying invested in the current system in terms of the current institutions that, that sustain both parties. And they play, you know, their ideological card in order to have an excuse not to make any fundamental changes.
Well,
I think that's really the situation.
So it's really a bipartisan nightmare here. And there's no real, as far as we can tell from within the system, save maybe a couple of proposals here and there from a Ron Paul, perhaps, or a Bernie Sanders, or, you know, people sort of outsiders who are nominally on the inside. It just seems as if they're locked into a trajectory that cannot in any way change this situation. And, you know, there's a growing desperation, and I think maybe that's the moment when the Occupy movements can, if they can, reach out to more Americans, reach out to people out of work or people trapped in debt or who have no options, and maybe try to get them involved. Because at this point, just an activist core is not enough. You know, I saw someone with a sign that says, "I am the 1% of the 99%. You know, we have to do better than that. So I'm going to wrap up right now. Aaron, thank you so much again for coming on and helping us understand what's happening. You're listening to News Dissector Radio. I'm Danny Schechter, your News Dissector. I do a blog every day at newsdissector.com. I've also been working on this issue for quite a while as an investigative journalist. I've made a film called Plunder, The Crime of Our Time. And part of that film is about the Bernie Madoff scandal, which we've been hearing more about because the wife has been in the news, but the reality of all the unanswered questions about this have not been really probed in any further. So we're going to go out with the song Plunder from the film Plunder, The Crime of Our Time. Thank you for listening. You can write to me at dissector@mediachannel.org. I hope you'll join me again next week. Same time, same station.
Your Honor, for many years, I operated a Ponzi scheme through the investment advisory side of my business. I knew what I was doing was wrong, indeed criminal.
The shine on America's shoes got gold.
When Wall Street stepped into the fold,
Congress paid off, workers paid off.
Stanford, AIG, and Madoff.
Credit swaps, credit stops, empty wallets, and empty